This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak with attorney Chesa Boudin from San Francisco.
Chesa literally went from jail to Yale, is one of the outstanding young criminal defense lawyers in the country today, and he's running for prosecutor as a progressive, and it's amazing. He could actually win.
2 decades ago, Purdue Pharma introduced the painkiller OxyContin. Today, the highly addictive drug has resulted in thousands of deaths across the United States.
200,000, as a matter of fact. The company is controlled by the Sackler family. It reminded me of the saying attributed to Honor Balzac, the French novelist, "Behind every great fortune is a great crime."
Stay with us. Michael Smith, congratulations are due. You have just published a book you've been working on for a while, Lawyers for the Left.
Subtitled, In the Courts, In the Streets, and On the Air. And therein lies the story, because a good part of this book is based on interviews that Heidi and I and Michael Ratner did on a segment of our show called Lawyers You'll Like.
Yes, we had some incredible interviews profiling people who were doing the work that very few in this country do, defending those who are often despised by the government. What motivated you to put this book together?
I think 9/11. You remember back then, Michael Ratner called the laws that they put down after 9/11, starting with the Patriot Act, but then the rest of them, which ultimately allowed for the government's ability to both kidnap and hold forever and then assassinate. They killed an American citizen, a man named Al Awlaki, at the Center for Constitutional Rights, took his father's case, but they threw it out of court. And that all scared us. So we got together, you and me and Michael, and in the early days, Dalia Hashad, a Muslim-American woman, and we went to WBAI, and they liked our idea. They put us on every other week. Then they put us on every week. When Michael died 3 years ago, we were on 60 stations around the country, and now we're on 120. Our show, Law and Disorder, is, in one sense, incorporated in this book that I've written called Lawyers for the Left. But it's more than that, because it's not just the interviews that we did, which were transcribed and edited with some of the most significant men and women in the country, but also essays that I wrote about various lawyers like William Kunstler, Leonard Boudin, the great African-American judge Bruce Wright, Conrad Lynn, Haywood Burns, who used to be the active in both the Lawyers Guild and the Center for Constitutional Rights. The book's available. You can get it at orbooks.com, orbooks.com. Its publication date is set a month from now, but it is available, and we'll have a discussion, a fuller discussion about it next week. Stay tuned.
Thanks, Michael. Michael, a couple of weeks ago, Lawrence Ferlinghetti turned 100 years old. As our listeners know, he's a poet, painter, activist, and co-founder of City Lights Booksellers in San Francisco.
City Lights was and still is one of the great small publishing houses in the United States. I remember back in the 50s, they published Allen Ginsberg's great poem, Howl, and the poem was suppressed. The government sued to keep it off the market. There was a big lawsuit.
And Michael, that was on the grounds that it was obscene.
Yeah, what was obscene was the activity of this government and this culture that he was describing, and they won the lawsuit. And then fast forward 50 years, because City Lights was the publisher of the great book Spying on Democracy, written by Heidi Boghossian. Heidi, what was your experience with City Lights?
Oh, what a lovely experience, and what an honor to be associated with a bookstore that has such a storied history. They were delightful, encouraging, set up some wonderful wonderful speaking engagements that I went out to the Bay Area for. So,
Did you have a chance to meet Ferlinghetti?
No. I have a friend who knew him back from the Beat days.
The amazing thing is that he still goes to the gym. He's active. He's 100 years old.
It's amazing.
And he's still writing poetry. And I wanted to share one of his recent poems called Pity the Nation with our listeners. Pity the nation whose people are sheep and whose shepherds mislead them. Pity the nation whose leaders are liars, whose sages are silenced, and whose bigots haunt the airwaves. Pity the nation that raises not its voice except to praise conquerors and acclaim the bully as hero and aims to rule the world by force and by torture. Pity the nation that knows no other language but its own and no other culture but its own. Pity the nation whose breath is money and sleeps the sleep of the too well-fed. Pity the nation, oh, pity the people who allow their rights to erode and their freedoms to be washed away. My country, 'tis of thee, sweet land of liberty.
Oh, such a fitting poem for these current days.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, Lawrence Ferlinghetti, happy 100th birthday.
Recently, we've seen attorneys across the country who are progressives run for the office of prosecutor. This is an office which many people associate with police departments with whom they closely work. The new crop of reform-minded prosecutors are saying that the criminal justice system is broken, that it's costly, classist, and racist. They say it is ineffective in keeping people safe and that two-thirds of the people convicted wind up back in prison in a few years. We speak today with attorney Chesa Boudin, who is currently an assistant public defender in San Francisco. He's running for the office of district attorney in that city. The ideas for reform in the criminal justice system that he has put forward in his campaign are receiving wide attention and wide support. Boudin was instrumental in getting the discriminatory practice of cash bail eliminated in San Francisco. We interviewed him about this a year ago on Law and Disorder.
Chesa, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much, Heidi. It's always great to be on the show.
Chesa, tell us a little bit about your childhood, your parents, and how that experience has led you to be active in criminal justice reform.
When I was just 14 months old, Heidi, both of my biological parents were arrested and sentenced to long prison terms for their role in a tragically bungled armed robbery that left three men dead. Growing up, I had to visit my parents in prison to build a relationship with them. I had to go through metal detectors and steel gates just to have physical contact with my parents. And, you know, so I've worked on and been directly impacted by issues of mass incarceration, by the prison industrial complex, my entire life. These are issues I've thought about since before I can even remember, and that I've worked on since as early as high school. It's something that when you visit prisons, you learn some really tough lessons. And I learned how broken our criminal justice system is, and I started working to fix it as early as high school, and it's why I became a lawyer and an attorney, to have the skills and the tools necessary to really take on our broken criminal justice system.
Now, what is your educational background and your work experience before you became a public defender in San Francisco? I understand you wrote a book called From Jail to Yale.
I think it was an article.
Oh, an article.
Yes, that's right, Michael. I wrote an article about that. And you know, I was a college student at Yale when my freshman year, I got a letter from my father from his prison telling me that he had a new neighbor on his cell block who claimed to be a friend of mine. And in fact, it was a friend of mine. It was a friend who I knew well, and who I had looked up to as a mentor when I was 5 or 6 years old in my mother's prison visiting room. Our mothers were incarcerated together. I was in my freshman year at Yale, and now he was behind bars with my father. The irony and the tragedy of that situation really impacted me quite profoundly. I went back to visit my friend at my father's prison. We rekindled our friendship, and we went on a deep dive together, reading, studying, and trying to understand how it was that our lives had taken such different paths. And I wrote an article called From Jail to Yale, in which we looked at the racial disparities in the country. You know, my friend, his name was Lorenzo, he was black and I'm white. We looked at, you know, geographic issues. You know, he grew up in a poor neighborhood in Brooklyn, and I grew up in a middle-class neighborhood in Chicago. And we looked at the fact that he was not a U.S. citizen, that he'd been born abroad, and that I was born here, and tried to make sense of the different risk factors and the different individual choices that we'd made that led to his incarceration and me being at one of the most privileged universities in the world. Ultimately, my friend Lorenzo was released from prison and deported back to the country he was born in but had no relationship with. And I went on to earn a Rhodes Scholarship and attend Yale Law School.
Chase Boudin, you're now working as a public defender in San Francisco. What's it like day to day? What do you do?
Well, I have been a public defender for a number of years. After law school, I clerked for two federal judges, and I helped launch an immigration unit at the San Francisco Public Defender. I helped launch an early representation unit here that's really the first of its kind in the country that provides advocacy for people before they've even been formally charged with a crime. And I've led our fight against money bail through partnerships with nonprofit organizations and law firms and academic institutions. We've had a tremendous impact on pushing California as a whole, as well as San Francisco in particular, to end the use of discriminatory money bail. But on a day-to-day basis, I'm also assigned to represent individual people accused of committing crimes who are too poor to pay for their own lawyer, and to make sure that they can exercise their constitutional rights and that the system fairly and accurately determines whether they're correctly accused, and if so, what an appropriate punishment is.
Chase, what do you think it takes to reduce recidivism and redirect those arrested to school and then employment?
Well, I know firsthand, because I've worked with people who have committed crimes for so many years, and I've visited prisons for so many years, that there are models that work, and there are models that simply don't work. And unfortunately, what we're doing right now doesn't work. Two-thirds of people coming home from state prison in California, as in many states, will end up back incarcerated within just a few years. We're not rehabilitating people. It's a revolving door that actually makes us less safe. I think what works is a recognition of and an understanding of the root causes of crime and addressing those root causes in the way that we hold people accountable for violating the law. So, for example, in San Francisco, three-quarters of people booked into county jail suffer from severe mental illness, drug addiction, or both. If we don't recognize that reality, and if we don't incorporate it into the punishment and the accountability for people who commit crimes, then we can't expect them to change their behavior.
What can the system do to better serve victims of crime?
Oh, so much, Michael. I'm glad you asked that question, because one of the big failings and disgraces of the criminal justice system as it works today is that for all the billions of dollars we spend punishing people, mostly young black and brown men, processing their bodies through cages and through prisons, we do so little for the people who've actually suffered their crimes. You know, it's an area where there are some jurisdictions doing really good work in restorative justice programs, for example, really making sure that every victim of every crime has a voice and can be heard, and that the outcome can actually directly focus on making right the wrong. But most jurisdictions don't care about victims. They care about punishing people. As San Francisco District Attorney, I'm committed to giving every victim of every crime a voice in the outcome and to establishing a restorative justice program that allows those victims to sit down across the table from the person that harmed them and can confront them in a mediated space. I think that's critical both to changing behavior of people who commit crimes and to empowering victims to move past the trauma of being victimized.
Chase, so what is wrong with the system of cash bail?
Cash bail is a fundamentally discriminatory part of the criminal justice system, and it really undermines the very integrity of the entire system. Cash bail is basically a system where the wealthy can buy their freedom as soon as they're arrested, no matter how dangerous they are, no matter how strong the evidence against them is. It totally undermines public safety in that way. And meanwhile, the poor languish in jail, no matter how weak the evidence against them, no matter how little risk they pose to society. And as a result, many people who are too poor to purchase their freedom will plead guilty simply to get out of jail rather than waiting for a trial date. And as a result, many people who are wealthy will buy their freedom and continue to engage in criminal activity that puts all of us at risk. As a result of this system, we not only discriminate against the most vulnerable and marginalized members of our community, but we also undermine the veracity of criminal convictions because people plead guilty as a result of their inability to post bail, not because they're actually guilty of crimes. We need to move past and away from a system of money bail. And what I've fought for in San Francisco is a system where there's a presumption of innocence, there's a presumption of release, but for those people who aren't safe to be released, it doesn't matter how rich they are. If a judge finds after a rigorous adversarial hearing that someone is not safe and there's no conditions that can make it safe to release someone to the community, then they should be detained pending trial, regardless of how many zeros are in their bank account.
Now, immigrants are getting picked up and deported. What can we do to protect immigrants from deportation?
It's a critical issue in terms of public safety. And I'm, as district attorney, I'm focused on making San Francisco a safer place for all of its residents. And that includes the immigrant community. We know that immigrants are often victims of crime. And if local law enforcement cooperates with ICE in the deportation machine of the Trump administration, then the immigrant community is not going to feel comfortable reporting crimes, testifying in court, or participating in criminal investigations. So it's imperative that local law enforcement fully protect our immigrant community from ICE and let the immigrant community know that we have your back, that we want to work with you, not against you. And that's the same motivation that led me to launch the San Francisco Public Defenders Immigration Unit back in 2012 to work with the sheriff in San Francisco back in 2013 to begin a policy, and a policy that I really drafted for the sheriff, of non-cooperation with ICE to ensure that our immigrant community trusts and cooperates with law enforcement and has the full protection of local government.
Chase, we referenced recidivism a few minutes ago. Can you talk briefly about the problem? I understand 2/3 of those who are arrested and prosecuted in San Francisco come back into the system within a few years. How do we break this cycle of crime and incarceration?
Well, it starts with, as I said, it starts with recognizing the root causes of crime. And in San Francisco, we're using the jail as a massive revolving door for people who are mentally ill, drug addicted, and homeless. And it's the most expensive, least humane way to deal with those problems that drive their behavior. So, we have a lot of low-level folks who come to jail for just a few days. In fact, in San Francisco, 65% of people who come into the county jail will spend less than a week there. And, that experience of just a few days of incarceration actually makes it more likely for people to commit crime. It actually destabilizes lives. So we take folks who are either homeless or marginally housed, who are vulnerable, and we put them in jail for 2, 3, 4 days and then release them. And that experience, if they're homeless, they've lost all their property. If they had a job in a restaurant, they've probably just lost their job for missing work. If they were on medication, they probably missed their medication and are now destabilized mentally or physically. So we need to find ways to focus our resources in terms of jail and prison on the relatively small percentage of people who are truly dangerous. And we need to figure out ways to triage all the rest of the people, the low-level folks who are having misdemeanor interactions with the police or whose incarceration is a result of substance use. We need to triage those people into meaningful services and treatment that are going to address the root causes rather than making it more likely they commit crime by incarcerating them for a few days or weeks.
Chase, I wanted to talk to you about the reality that the law is not equally enforced. Can you talk to us about police misconduct, political corruption, corporate crime, and law-breaking landlords?
Thanks, Michael. Yeah, one of the biggest disgraces of our system, you know, of our rule of law, is that the law is not enforced equally. And, you know, unfortunately, we live in a world where police can get away with murder, where criminal laws are virtually never enforced against landlords who fraudulently evict tenants, or against corporations that pollute and you know, contaminate our environment, even when the conduct is explicitly criminalized. There's no resources or political will to investigate or prosecute. And it's unacceptable that in our system, the quality of justice you receive depends on the color of your skin, the amount of money you have in your bank account, or what your job title is. But that's the reality today, and I'm committed to changing that as San Francisco District Attorney. I'm going to do it by shifting resources away from sort of traditional petty offenses that we know result in horrific racial disparities and cause so much damage to our poorest communities and our communities of color. And I'm going to focus those resources instead and in addition on enforcing the law against everyone, political corruption, fraudulent evictions, environmental contamination, and of course police if they violate the law.
It's interesting you mention that, Chase, because recently we interviewed Alexandra Nadipoff, who has written a book on misdemeanors and the devastating impact that they have on families and communities across the country. Can you briefly speak about how the prosecutor's office is allocating resources that you just referenced between violent felonies and lesser misdemeanors?
Well, it's an important issue that you raised, and we can all agree, regardless of what our political perspective is or, you know, what our particular experiences are in life, we can all agree that the crimes we care the most about, that have the most serious consequences for victims in the community and that have the highest stakes for the people arrested and accused of them, are the serious and violent crimes, rape, murder, assault with a firearm, armed robbery, etc. Those are the crimes that necessarily require the most attention, the most resources. Yet in San Francisco, two-thirds of the jury trials are for misdemeanors. Two-thirds of the cases clogging up courtrooms, calling in members of the community to serve as jurors, requiring a judge and all the court staff and lawyers to spend a week or more adjudicating the issues are misdemeanors, petty offenses. And as a result, we don't have courtrooms available in San Francisco to judiciously and expeditiously move the serious cases through the system. It's an inversion of the way we should be doing things. We should be doing two-thirds felony trials, serious felonies, but instead it's the opposite, and that's going to change under my watch as district attorney.
So what kind of support, Chase Aboudin, what kind of support are you getting for the ideas that you've been sharing with us? You know, it seems to me that what you say is so humane and so reasonable, and particularly in San Francisco, which we all think is an enlightened place, that you'd be getting a lot of support. Is that true?
It is true, Michael, and I've been really humbled by the outpouring of support. I'm a first-time candidate. I never set up to run for office before. I never really thought about running for office. And since I announced in January, I've just been really overwhelmed by the support and the response from voters. I've been endorsed by organizations, including Sean King's Real Justice PAC. I've been endorsed by Californians for Safety and Justice, the San Francisco Tenants Union, and a wide range of elected officials here in San Francisco. You know, on our Board of Supervisors, I've been endorsed by four separate members, as well as the chair of the local Democratic Party, and a number of other elected officials who serve around the country, the Lieutenant Governor of Washington State, the Mayor of Mill Valley, City Council men and women from around the Bay Area, and numerous members of the local Democratic Party, you know, as well as former elected officials in San Francisco and community leaders, and of course leaders in the legal community, including a large number of current and former members of our police commission, who recognize that my policies and my commitment to equal enforcement of the law will make San Francisco a safer place for all of its residents.
Chase, I know nothing about the local politics, but what is the current district attorney's office like right now?
Well, it's an interesting dynamic. It's the first time in 110 years when there's no incumbent running for re-election. There's no one actually from within the district attorney's office even running for this position. I'm the only candidate out of four candidates in the race who even works in our criminal courts today. The current district attorney's office is run by a man named George Gascon, who is widely viewed around the country as a leader in progressive prosecution policies. He helped launch our Veterans Justice Court, and he's helped expand our behavioral health court and our drug court, as well as our young adult court and a number of other alternative programs for people who are, you know, particularly vulnerable and get caught up in the criminal justice system. And he's refused to prosecute, for example, sex work or a number of other low-level misdemeanors such as homelessness and illegal camping. So George Gascon has been a model for prosecutors around the country in terms of progressive work, but there's a lot of work that, you know, remains to be done in San Francisco. It's far from perfect, and of course the police fought him every step of the way on many of these issues, and I'm hoping to build on and expand his progressive legacy while some of the other candidates in the race announced that they were running to challenge him before he'd even decided not to run for re-election. They were challenging him from the right. And so what's at stake in this race is whether we're going to take a you know, a reasonably progressive prosecutor and build on that legacy, expand it, push the ball further as a model for the rest of the country, or whether we're going to undo the positive policies he's put in place and move back towards a traditional tough-on-crime approach.
You know, it's amazing. Heidi and I are sitting here listening to you, and it dawned on us that you really could win.
Yes. Oh, yeah. We're in it to win it, Michael. That's for sure. We are in it to win it, and we've got a tremendous amount of support. If you drive around San Francisco, you'll see my signs up in bedroom windows and convenience stores and, you know, all across it, nail salons, restaurants, all over San Francisco. You'll see my signs, and, you know, you won't see signs of my competitors.
Nice.
You know, we're competitive in terms of fundraising. We're competitive in terms of endorsements, and we're leading the way in terms of our ground game. This is about people power. It's about, you know, really empowering the communities that are most affected by crime, and we've had a tremendous amount of support in our first couple months.
How can people learn more about criminal justice reform, and specifically about what you're doing? Do you have a website?
We do, Michael, and I'd love it if your listeners would take a look and get involved. They can sign up to volunteer. They can learn more about what we're doing on our website. That's at www.chesaboudin.com. chesaboudin.com. www.chesaboudin.com. We got a video up there that tells my life story in just a couple minutes, and we have a bunch of news articles and a list of all of our endorsements and some substantive policy ideas about how we're going to really reform criminal justice.
Chase, if you're elected, we want a promise from you that you'll be a guest at least once back on Law and Disorder.
Oh, that's a promise I'm very happy to make. I'm making a lot of promises about the changes we're going to implement in San Francisco, and I will add this promise to the list. If and when elected, I promise I will appear at least once a year during my term on Law and Disorder. How's that?
That's just great, Chase Aboudin. Thank you so much for being our guest. Every success in what you're trying to accomplish, we'll be checking in with you. You take it easy.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org. Thank you.
In March, the maker of OxyContin and the family that owns the company reached a $270 million settlement with the state of Oklahoma over the painkiller's role in the nation's opioid crisis. Purdue Pharma is based in Stamford, Connecticut, and is controlled by the Sackler family. The money will go toward creating a National Center for Addiction Studies and Treatment at Oklahoma State University in Tulsa. The deal comes 2 months before Oklahoma's lawsuit against Purdue and other pharmaceuticals blamed for the crisis was set to go to trial. Purdue Pharma introduced OxyContin more than 2 decades ago, marketing the highly addictive drug aggressively to physicians. It has made billions of dollars from the drug, but faces approximately 2,000 lawsuits from state and local governments trying to hold the company responsible for the deadly epidemic. The Centers for Disease Control reports that prescription opioids like OxyContin were a factor in a record 48,000 deaths across the U.S. in 2017. Purdue Pharma has settled other lawsuits over the years, and 3 executives pled guilty to criminal charges in 2007. But this is the first settlement to come out of the current coast-to-coast wave of litigation, focusing on the company's more recent conduct. It threatens to drive Purdue into bankruptcy. Joining us to talk about the history of how OxyContin became such a public health problem and who's behind it is Liz White, an award-winning reporter for the investigation news organization, the Center for Public Integrity in Washington, D.C. Liz, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me.
Liz, let's start by telling our listeners a bit about the Center for Public Integrity. We know it was founded in 1989, and its goal is to focus on data-driven reporting and a quest for government transparency.
That's right. We are a nonprofit newsroom based in Washington, D.C. We're funded by grants and generous contributions, and we focus on politics, the environment, areas of influence that the public may not know about.
Okay. On the subject of opioids, I understand that years ago they were reserved pretty much for terminally ill patients and the most severe kinds of pain. But that changed, and we saw a rise around 1992 in prescriptions for conditions like arthritis, back pain, and even headaches. Can you describe what factors led to that change?
A lot of it was driven by pharmaceutical company marketing. The poster boy for this is obviously OxyContin, made by Purdue Pharma. It became really famous as just a drug that was being abused in the late 90s, early 2000s, and onward. And part of that was because, you know, drug makers were saying, hey, pain is undertreated. There are a lot of people who are in pain who shouldn't be. And a great, really safe and way that will not lead to abuse to treat it is an opioid, which we now know to be false. I mean, there are a lot of people who got addicted. But that was kind of the line that they were using with doctors and prescribers and saying this is a really safe way to go and you don't need to worry about your patient having any kind of addiction issues. If they get on it, they'll just have better quality of life and all of that. And so there was kind of a big push in hospitals and doctors' clinics to make pain the fifth vital sign, something you would check with every patient, something you would address in every case. You know, since then, heightened awareness of the opioid crisis, there's been a lot of discrediting of those ideas.
Liz, in 2007, Purdue Pharma pled guilty and agreed to pay more than $600 million in fines for misleading the public about the risks of OxyContin. How is it that the drug continued to rack up blockbuster sales, generating more than $22 billion over the last decades?
That's a great question. Obviously, the wave of prescribing has continued. There are still doctors out there who are very generous with their opioid prescribing. Less and less, so I think more and more doctors are aware of changes that need to be made. But In addition, Purdue Pharma was facing an expiration of its original patent on OxyContin, and so it did what a lot of drug companies do, which is tweaked the drug slightly to extend the patent. One of the ways it did that was to make it what they call tamper-resistant or abuse-deterrent. And a lot of the other opioid makers did this too. So they pulled their original drugs in some cases and came out with abuse deterrent versions and really sold this to both doctors and lawmakers and public policy makers as a solution to the opioid crisis, as in, here's a great tool in our toolbox for fighting this. And they ended up making more money by selling these drugs that they said were going to, you know, help fix the crisis they originally helped to create. Even went around from state to state and got states to pass laws that significantly favored their new, more expensive drugs over older versions of painkillers. And the sad thing is that really the effects of these abuse deterrent drugs were kind of oversold. You know, you can still abuse a painkiller by just swallowing it, and other people with real severe drug problems. I mean, I talked to a guy who in a past life had been able to get around the abuse deterrent properties of some of these drugs with, you know, a microwave and some lemon juice. So they were really oversold as a solution, but they made them a lot of money.
Liz, I'm confused. When you say abuse deterrent, are you talking about things like Narcan, or are you saying that they changed something like OxyContin in terms of its chemistry? Are we talking two different drugs?
Yeah, so they took drugs like OxyContin or Opana or different versions of these opioid narcotics, and they did things like made them harder to crush. So they had, around the country, they had all these, which is a way that, you know, abusers would sniff them or snort them by crushing them. So they would have all these demonstrations with lawmakers and, you know, pulling out the pill and wielding their hammer and trying to crush it, and they couldn't. And then therefore it was a better drug and it was going to save a lot of people. Or they had different other chemical formulations too that would basically take out the painkilling properties of the drug if you messed it up in some way. I'm trying to make that as simple as I can, but yes, they changed the chemistry of the drug to try to beat how they thought abusers were using it.
You know, to put this in context, I read in the New York Times that about 200,000 people have died from overdoses in the last several decades, and that the Sackler family that controls Purdue is worth billions of dollars. And my question to you, Liz, is what did members of the Sackler family know about the dangers of this drug, and when did they know it?
That's a great question. We're finding out more and more of that via some new lawsuits that have been filed. Purdue obviously has already paid that $600 million in fines. They've been faced with lawsuits for years over opioids, and now some of the newer ones are not only going after Purdue Pharma, the company, but the Sackler family. And there's several branches of the Sackler family with various involvement in the company, but some of the newer lawsuits from, like, the New York Attorney General and the Massachusetts Attorney General are alleging that the Sackler family, certain members, were intimately involved with the marketing of painkillers and were even frustrated when, you know, sales started to go down and put a lot of pressure on the company to continue ratcheting up sales marketing of OxyContin even when the crisis was worsening.
For several years, and I think it was up to around 2012, the Federal Drug Administration was working on developing risk management plans to reduce the misuse of long-acting opioids. Listeners may know the FDA oversees drug makers and their marketing efforts, which you've just alluded to. But the FDA plans actually lacked major reforms that were suggested by the agency itself in 2009 when it announced it was doing this. And instead of mandatory certification training for doctors and electronic registries to track opioid prescriptions, the FDA official outlined milder steps. Drug makers would fund optional classes for prescribers and supply pharmacy brochures to patients. Why did this happen? Why did the FDA flake out on this?
Yeah, that's something we addressed in our three-part series we did in 2016 called The Politics of Pain, which you can find by Googling Politics of Pain, Center for Public Integrity. We did this with the Associated Press. One of the things we found was that a Purdue lobbyist named Bert Rosen had helped found this group called the Pain Care Forum in Washington. And basically every month it was Purdue, Janssen, other drug makers who are making a lot of money off of opioids, and a collection of nonprofits they had funded, such as the American Pain Foundation, would get together and kind of strategize about ways to make pain a very important talking point in Washington policy circles and fight against any restrictions on opioids. And so we found that as early as 2008, Pain Care Forum was talking about informing the process at the FDA, and they ended up, when the FDA was thinking about doing these more strict oversight, they generated, you know, thousands of comments, a 4,000 signature petition, basically opposing these electronic registries for opioid prescriptions, which almost all states have now, and they've been hugely helpful in helping prevent things like doctor shopping. But there was a lot of input to the FDA from this very loud coalition. And then, you know, we talked to people, too, who said, we think pretty much the FDA was on board with this talking point that was coming out of these groups that said, you know, we need to balance the concerns of pain patients and the opioid abuse epidemic. And certainly pain patients do have valid concerns, and there are many of them, but at the same time, there's very little scientific research showing that opioids are really effective for long-term chronic pain. They're much more effective for short-term use, and long-term they have many risks associated with them. But yeah, really the FDA was swayed by many of that influence that the Pain Care Forum had.
You know, the New York Times ran a headline front page story on April 1st, and it wasn't an April Fool's story either. And it's really, in my mind, a Pulitzer Prize-winning article exposing what's going on here. And the authors of the Times article wrote, and I'd like you to reflect on this, they wrote, "But as the country's addiction crisis worsened, the Sacklers spied another business opportunity. They could increase their profits by selling treatments for the very problem their company had helped create, addiction to opioids. And they developed a drug that they could sell on the back end, so they're working both sides of the street." What did you find out about this?
That story was kind of summarizing some of the findings from that New York Attorney General lawsuit that I talked about, which actually relied heavily on our reporting from 2016. It was cited several times. And then the Massachusetts Attorney General lawsuit. Yeah, the Times basically outlined how for a while Purdue had this special project going in which they were going to try to come out at the back end with an opioid addiction treatment, I think it was a form of buprenorphine, that they would market, and that one of the Sacklers was actually involved in that effort. You read the lawsuit, it looks really bad for them. I mean, it's just pinky in the brain taking over the world, evil kind of stuff. But yeah, I don't think they ended up going forward with that initiative. I think someone was said, this looks bad for us, we shouldn't do it. But you know, the Purdue is still making tons of money off of painkillers, and the Sackler family is still very wealthy thanks to their $1 billion of sales over the years.
Liz, I want to talk just a little bit more about the Pain Care Forum. It's my understanding they are no longer in existence. Is that correct?
Yes, but for many years they kind of drove the conversation in Washington regarding pain. So they got together every month and they talked about how to, you know, make sure that painkillers were seen as a good thing, as a way to treat this chronic problem of pain in the United States. And one of the things they did was they lobbied heavily for the creation of this Institute of Medicine report on pain, and they sponsored a bill a couple times, and ended up getting passed in the 2010 healthcare reform. But basically had a panel of people put together a report on pain itself, and the panel was heavily weighted by people who worked for nonprofits that got money from pharma, that kind of thing. And it came out with this figure that said 100 million people in America are, you know, are in pain and they need help. And that's a lot of people. And we've talked to one of the guys whose research undergirded that number, and he said that's really the way they're using that was incorrect. That, I mean, that includes everyone from someone who stubbed their toe to someone with really serious chronic pain. And but that talking point, 100 million people in pain, got circulated across, you know, the Washington echo chamber and ended up in one of the FDA commissioner's speeches as this really urgent justification for why balance was the number one priority versus kind of attacking the opioid crisis head on.
And Liz, I think they actually use the term chronic pain. And Liz, I think the term they used was actually chronic pain, making it sound like more of an ongoing life-impairing issue.
Right, yes. And there are a lot of people in chronic pain, and you'll probably get some angry listeners who call in after this interview and say, but I'm in pain. And it's so true, and I feel so bad for those people, and I've talked to many of them. But at the end of the day, the truth is that there just isn't good evidence that taking opioids long-term, especially in higher doses, is overall good for people with that kind of pain. It can really lead to dependence and addiction, and for so many people it has morphed into a much worse problem where they end up needing their painkillers and maybe even, you know, searching for other alternatives when they can't get them. And that's what a lot of people did who, you know, were prescribed for a toothache or whatever, ended up getting a huge amount of painkillers, and then when they couldn't get them had to turn to heroin and fentanyl, and that's why we have the number of deaths we have today.
We're speaking with Liz White from the Center for Public Integrity. Liz, I read your amazing report, and it brought to my mind the infamous observation of Honoré Balzac, the French author, who said that behind every great fortune is a great crime. And I wanted to ask you about the Sackler family's funding of several museum exhibits here in New York at the Metropolitan Museum, the Oriental Art, that temple they funded. They funded exhibits in London, Columbia University, at the Louvre in Paris. Have their names been removed from these exhibits? Please talk about that aspect of the scandal.
No, they have not been removed. There's even one here in Washington, D.C. And I would say, you know, there are three main branches of the Sackler family. And one of the branches was not as involved in the company and claims, you know, we shouldn't be blamed for this at all. This has nothing to do with us. But ProPublica did some great reporting recently suggesting that that's not quite the case and that a lot of their money stems from the success of OxyContin as well. So, yeah, I would say that I don't know if any of these museums are seriously considering removing names, but certainly it gives you pause to see that name in so many prestigious places.
Liz, I have a very basic question. Where were the physicians amidst all of this lobbying and nasty goings on over the last decade plus? Don't doctors, I would think, have to approach pain dispensing with a common sense approach, especially after they're seeing the kinds of numbers of addiction coming from Oxy and other drugs?
Yeah, well, I would say there's a number of different types of doctors involved. There are obviously those doctors who have been prosecuted and went to jail and were, you know, essentially just pill mills, just doling out the painkillers freely for money. Those are, you know, the really egregious examples. And then there were also doctors who, you know, were just hearing a lot of more and more messaging coming from not only straight from drug makers, but from groups that they considered authoritative, such as the Federation of State Medical Boards, saying that we needed to be more lenient with opioid prescribing and be more generous because people were suffering in pain. But little did they know that some of those authoritative sources were also being influenced by drug makers, which we've shown in our reporting and other Milwaukee Sentinel Journal did some great reporting on that years ago. So just saying, well, you know, if this is the medical consensus, then that's what I should do. And kind of years later realizing that maybe that had some bad effects. And I will say, like, companies like Purdue and Janssen and Teva, they were all sponsoring, too, these medical education seminars that doctors have to take that said the same things, that, you know, there was no risk of addiction with opioids, that they should be dispensed more freely, that kind of thing. And, you know, there were great efforts at putting out official prescribing guides that were mailed out to all kinds of doctors and that kind of thing. I even, in one of my recent reporting endeavors, which wasn't even focused on opioids, found that Purdue had sponsored this seminar for state Medicaid officials back in the day, in which they told this forum of state Medicaid officials that opioids are not addictive, you know, there was really no cause to be worried, opioid addiction was a myth. You know, when you're subjected to that barrage of information, it becomes overwhelming.
Liz, Purdue Pharma faces approximately 2,000 lawsuits from state and local governments. And just a few weeks ago, it reached a $270 million settlement with the state of Oklahoma. I understand that many families are distressed at settlements because it means that Purdue won't have to go to court and divulge some information that, with the settlement, will probably remain confidential. What is your feeling about settlements in this area?
Yeah, obviously, I'm a reporter, and I like more information rather than less information. So a settlement is kind of always a disappointment in terms of, you know, you want the information to be out there and not to just get buried and sealed. I will say there are other lawsuits that have a lot of potential in terms of digging up some of the details about the relationship between Purdue and these other companies and the opioid crisis. So, you know, Oklahoma may kind of just be the first one, and we'll see what happens. The background there is that Purdue has actually talked publicly about declaring bankruptcy to protect itself from some of these lawsuits. And so, I don't know, there may be some kind of strategizing on behalf of lawyers about how to handle that.
You know, I just want to point out to our listeners that Purdue set up an alternative company. Purdue works out of Connecticut, but they set up another company called Rhodes in Rhode Island to sell the same addictive drug, but a generic form of it. So they established what's been called a landing pad. And another thing that is disturbing is that unless the personal assets of the Sackler family are reached, they're going to get off scot-free by doing what you just mentioned, bankruptcy. Do you think that it's possible to reach their personal assets?
That's for someone much wiser and smarter than me. I will say the newer wave of litigation does name certain Sackler family members personally, not just as, you know, Purdue Pharma, and so I guess it would be possible.
Liz, how can listeners read more of what you've written and get in touch with the center?
Yeah, the center's at publicintegrity.org, and you can find all of our opioid reporting under Politics of Pain, if you just want to search that when you get to our website or Google it. It's a series we did with the Associated Press. It was in a lot of newspapers nationwide. And then I'm on Twitter, if you want to look me up, Liz Esley White. And would love to hear from people.
That's White with a Y.
And it's just
White
to repeat.
White with a Y, yeah.
Liz Esley White.
Handle is L_E_White with a Y.
Liz, it's really been a pleasure to talk to you about this very disturbing subject. And we hope to have you back on again when we see more lawsuits winding their way through court.
Great, yeah. Thanks for having me.
Have a great day.
Keep up the good work,
you
Liz.
Too.
Thanks so much.
Bye-bye.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org.